Attention musicians, I know if you're like me, being stuck in this quarantine, you've been sitting around playing every song you know. Are you looking to learn more songs? Well, I have the app for you. Whether you're a professional musician or a beginner, Ultimate Guitar is an amazing app for you. For just $2.99, you get the chords and tabs for over a million songs on guitar, bass, and ukulele. You also get a bunch of tools, man, amazing tools like a tuner, metronome, chord library, lessons, videos, and more. Go to ultimateguitar.com or download the app from your app store today. That's Ultimate Guitar. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope that you are safe and healthy wherever it is that you are listening to this show. Things are serious out there, and I hope that you're okay. I hope that your mental state is okay. If you're not, if your physical health is okay, I hope your mental health is okay. I've been getting a little bit dark, going a little dark. In the mind last couple days. That happens, I think, in these situations, and you start to see the reality of everything that's happening and sort of the gravity of what lies ahead. It can be overwhelming. And so if you're like me, I'm having it too, man. I'm having the same feelings you are of insecurity, of helplessness, of insanity from being inside alone, a little bit of paranoia, you know, to getting scared. Am I getting this? Am I passing this? I'm doing everything I can to isolate. I haven't seen people. I haven't come in contact with anyone in days. And that gets weird too. Like that starts wearing on you, you know, the panic. Anyway, I hope that you guys are all doing well. I hope that your mental health is okay. I hope that your physical health is okay. I hope that your loved ones are okay. This is a tough time for all of us. And I just wanted to share how I was feeling with you guys because you're probably feeling the same way. And we're all in this together, so might as well talk about it. Feeling scared, feeling insecure. It's all happening right now, right? I've been finding ways to distract myself, playing some music. I did something for a video with Robert Harrison and Susanna Schoffel yesterday. I think it's going to be real cool. I mean, I hope their song's real awesome, but I lent them some images of myself, some video I made of myself here in the house playing guitar and playing piano. I've been playing a lot of guitar, been playing a lot of piano. Feels good. I feel like I got to start fucking running Skyrocket sets, or by the time this thing comes back, I'm not going to remember any of the songs. So I am going to start setting up like a sort of like an hour a day of like Skyrocket practice, because that's a lot of songs we know. And to come back from not doing this for a while, I don't know how long it'll be. I want to be prepared and ready to go. So yeah. Look, I'm doing what I can to keep my sanity. I'm doing podcasts. I'm talking to people. Today is no different. I have the great Peter Blackstock on the show today. Yeah, music journalist, great writer. He was the co-founder and editor of No Depression magazine. If you remember that magazine, it was around from like late 90s to the like 2008 when they went under. But he tells me the whole story about it. Great story, great guy. He writes for the Austin American Statesman now. He is there. You can find him at austin360.com. And you can find him on Twitter at Blackstock360. Now, he's the guy that's curating a great list, like an ongoing Google Doc, of everyone that's doing live streams every day. And so if you are a musician here in Austin, you're planning on doing a live stream, hit him up at Blackstock360 on Twitter. Let him know when you're playing, and he'll add you to the doc, okay? He's got a fascinating story. He's a really great guy. As I said, I've been a fan of his writing for a long time. I was a fan of No Depression magazine. And I know that magazine... I don't know if I talked to him about it, but I feel like that magazine really, really did perpetuate what we know now as Americana, and sort of gave it its own avenue to sort of be talked about and celebrated. And I think that No Depression magazine just really had a huge part in bringing bands out, like artists like Patty Griffin and people like that. I know that there was a lot of people from this area, Alejandro Escovedo, a lot of people. He brought the spotlight onto a lot of Americana artists that we all know now, Lucinda Williams, people like this. I know that Rolling Stone and stuff was writing about them, but this guy was really writing these big features about them because they were the biggest bands to this scene that he was being a big part of with No Depression magazine. Anyway, Peter is a great writer. He's very involved with music. He's been watching those live streams. I've seen him write stuff about him every day. And so he's out there. He's watching it. He's involved. He's a real music fan. All right. He's from here in Austin. I think he was born in Rochester, New York, but he moved here when he was very small and was raised here in Austin and was a part of South by Southwest, a part of the awards, a part of a lot of things. And we have a great conversation. He's just a great guy. So without further ado, gang, enjoy my conversation with the incredibly talented and extremely cool Peter Blackstock. Let's get down. So are you working from home right now?
Yeah, all of us are. Have been for more than a week. I think it was Friday a week ago, so the 13th, when the order went out from the people in the office that everybody was going to work at home. I had already started working at home by that point because I actually had gotten sick earlier that week with a cold that was like, well, I don't know what this is, so I had to, from that point, as soon as I got a cold, I had to stay in. And yeah. I actually was fortunate enough to actually go up to the drive-through testing place in North Austin that Baylor Scott and White was doing and got tested and got a negative, and so then, which was a huge relief, and I knew I didn't have it. But in the meantime, I was like, I can't go anywhere because I might be transmitting. You know?
So, right. How can I ask you a question? Just like, I know that you put together this document of all the live streams that were going on last week.
Yeah.
And at let's say Friday night, do you know how many ones were happening locally?
I was impressed because we started it on Monday. I launched the page on Monday a week ago today. And immediately in the first day, got about 50 submissions. At this point, we're up to about 125 that have actually sent their stuff in to the page that we put out there for it.
Wow.
And it was pretty consistently more than 10 a day. And I think Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it was more like 15 a day. Today there was, you know, it's a Monday, somewhat less, maybe half a dozen, but they pick up a lot by middle of the week. The one thing that has really become clear is that a lot of artists are going to start doing residencies, basically, you know.
Yeah.
Residencies from home.
Right.
And so they're picking a day each week to, you know, every Wednesday at 3 p.m. tune into my thing, that kind of deal.
Right. Yeah, it seemed like at one point, like on Friday, like between 6 and like 11 p.m., it was crazy. Anytime I went on social media, like I'd get an alert, so-and-so just started a live video, so-and-so just started a live video. Like it was pretty insane, which is great. You know, people are out there, they're doing their thing. It looks like people are able to give at this point, which is good.
Yeah, I think the big concern long-term for me is not that whether musicians will keep doing this, because I think they will, because the technology is easy now.
Right.
And musicians still want to play, you know. They still want to make music. Early on, the reports I was getting were very positive about what people were bringing in, what people were tipping and donations and stuff.
Right.
And I was really glad to hear that. I mean, I had at least one person told me that it was about as good as they would have done on a good bar gig, you know. The question is, will people continue donating when when the audience is starting to have cash flow problems too, because that's the thing about this. We, you know, I focus on musicians because that's what I write about, but this is affecting almost every single sector of the
right economy. Right, totally. It's incredibly overwhelming. And it's unprecedented, like something we've never seen before. Are you the music editor at the Austin American Statesman?
No. It's different than the way it tends to work at the Chronicle or Alt Weeklies, which alternative weeklies generally have like a music editor position.
Uh-huh.
Daily papers, we are just part of an umbrella of the features department.
Okay.
So we have a features editor, we have an entertainment editor specifically, and then we have writers who cover music and film and restaurants and things like that. And I'm one of our two staff music writers. Deborah Singupta Stith is the other one.
Okay. So, man, I'm very interested in hearing your story. Where are you from? Where were you born?
Well, I'm almost a native Austinite.
Okay.
I was actually born in Rochester, New York. And my father, who is 90 years old now, is a native Austinite. He was born here in 1930.
Okay.
And in 1969, he got an offer to come teach at the University of Texas, which is his alma mater. So the whole family moved down here. I was 4 years old at the time.
Okay.
And so I grew up in Austin. For all intents and purposes, I've always felt like a native Austinite.
Yeah. What did he teach at UT?
He was in the mechanical engineering and physics departments, specializes in acoustics.
Okay. Wow. All right. So so you grew up here in town, and when did music hit you where it was like, obviously a person that dedicates their life to writing about music has some kind of like the same kind of epiphany that somebody that plays like someone like I do, where it touches you one day and you're like, that's it. I'm giving my life to this thing.
Yeah. I feel like I had, you know, that moment or those moments. And when I look back, part of it was, I think it was ingrained into me by the time I was about 9 or 10 years old, because looking back, I realized that I was unusual among my friends in elementary school, fourth or fifth grade. Everybody else would go home after school and watch cartoons. I would go home after school and listen to the radio.
Yeah.
And I was taping stuff off the radio with my little cassette player, and I was tuning into Casey Kasem's American Top 40 every Saturday and writing down all the Top 40 songs in spiral notebooks that I actually still have. So I realized music was going to be something special in my life early on. It's just, it didn't ever occur to me that it could be what I do
until
I got into the college, really. By high school, I knew I wanted to be a journalist, but I really was expecting to be a sports writer. And I started at the Statesman when I was 17 years old, a senior at McCallum High School, and I was working in the sports department there, basically taking like high school football statistics over the phone from coaches.
Okay.
And gradually worked my way into one thing after another. But then once I got into school at UT, and people started saying, hey, you should go see so-and-so, the Commandos at the Hole in the Wall, or you should come see Doctor's Mob at the Continental Club. And I started going to see stuff, and friends would drag me to shows at Liberty Lunch. And this was definitely summer of 1985 when it just suddenly took over my life.
Yeah,
I was turning 20, and that was, from that point on, was always going to be part of my identity. But it took a couple years before I connected the dots and realized, well, this is what I should be writing about.
Right. And there were places then, because I lived here then, there were places like, I remember the beach.
Yeah.
Did you used to go there?
I did. Sadly, I lived like 1.5 blocks from the beach, and I didn't really start going until that scene was almost over. I did go there a few times, but it would have been so easy for me to go there every night, and I still kick myself of all the really cool stuff I missed in probably like 84 that I was living so near it, you know?
Yeah. So once you started, you said you saw Doctor's Mob. I remember that band. I think I remember them more as a name than having seen them or something. Who else did you see? Like, who else affected you back then?
Well, it was all of these bands in their sort of early mid-20s at that time that were starting to get national attention. A lot of that was because of that MTV series, The Cutting Edge.
Right, yeah.
That came to Austin to do a show, and so there was a big thing at Liberty Lunch, and they taped one night at South Bank, and they caught all of the big sort of, you know, alternative underground rock bands at that time. Doctor's Mob, True Believers, Zeitgeist, who became the Reavers.
Right.
Glass Eye, The Wild Seeds. Those
Daniel
five
Johnston
were always,
was on there?
And Daniel was, you know, sort of, the odd thing is that those five I just mentioned were the ones that I think everything was kind of revolving around.
Uh-huh.
But the ones who, from that MTV thing, ended up becoming really well known were Daniel and Timbuk 3, who
right.
were playing at the Hole in the Wall, but they both of those seemed like kind of outsiders, and it turned out that's who, you know, nationally the public at large really took to.
Right. I remember one of the best things was Dino Lee's quote in that, "Bring me all your women. Dead, dying, lying in the gutter, I'll take them all." That was like the weirdest.
He was certainly a big part of things at that time, too.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I ever went to go see Dino Lee. I knew he was not my thing because it was all this sort of theatrical, you know.
Yeah.
It was about so many more things than just the music, and it was really good for what he was doing.
Right.
It's just what I cared about was music and songwriting, and so when I wasn't seeing the alternative bands at Liberty Lunch and the Continental, where I was going was the Cactus to see Townes Van Zandt and Butch Hancock and the singer-songwriters.
Right. What was it about that attracted you to that? Because it wasn't like, as a young man, you obviously were in it for the music, because it's not like all the young ladies were going to see Townes Van Zandt and Butch Hancock. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was a different crowd. It was just, I don't know, something about the basic, you know, form of country folk songwriting really resonated with me, and I'm not sure why. It didn't necessarily connect to all of the top 40 radio stuff that I listened to when I was a kid, but I always liked singer-songwriters, I guess. You know, so much of that was going on in Austin when I was too young to go out and see it.
Right.
Willie and Michael Murphy and
right.
Stephen Fromholtz and that whole crew of Jeff Walker, all these really great artists who ended up being, you know, hugely significant on what Austin was and even still is as a music city.
Right.
So that maybe even though I was too young to go out and see those things, it might have had some impact on shaping what I was going to like when I got older.
Right. All right. So in college, were you majoring in journalism?
I didn't. I did minor in journalism, and I worked a little bit for the Daily Texan. But because I had started, I'd gotten a foot in the door starting working at the Statesman when I was 17. I was working there pretty regularly all through college. And one of the columnists at the Statesman, a guy named Mike Kelly, had advised me. He said, "You're already getting journalistic experience. You know, take a few reporting and layout and design classes at UT. But major in something else that'll make your worldview broader." And
I
thought that was actually pretty smart.
Yeah.
And so I actually majored in history. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Have you ever, do you use that in any way?
You know, not in a, not in a
your
real
work.
Specific way, but on the other hand, one of the sort of satellite jobs I did around in addition to working for newspapers for many years was I worked for South by Southwest on a part-time basis, like once a month for every year from like 89 to 97, so about 8 or 9 years.
Wow.
And I would write all of the band descriptions of all the bands that were playing for the big program guide that would come out. And the role that they gave, the title that South By gave me for doing that was archivist, which I always liked because it just made me feel like, oh, maybe I did use my history degree.
Yeah, I wonder if you wrote some about me back then.
Probably. It's entirely possible. Yeah. I'd have to dig back. But if you played during those years, I probably wrote a sentence or two about you.
I did. I did the I think my first one was 1990.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I was in a band from Houston then. So what did you do after college?
I basically, once I graduated from UT, which was spring of 88, I guess, I just transitioned into more or less full time at the Statesman, although I never was actually, only a couple occasions was I full time on staff there. But I was always writing about music, and I was working as a copy editor in the sports and news and features departments. Doing the copy editing, kind of, that was sort of my day gig, you know, and then writing about music was the fun part. And between the two, it was enough to make a living.
Okay. Do you remember who all you you wrote about, like one of your first music features?
I do remember the very first one. Okay. I had just come back from spending the summer in Anchorage, Alaska. I had a summer internship at the Anchorage Daily News. And it was a fascinating adventure to be in that place for 3 or 4 months, but it was also very isolating at a time when I had just become such a fan of Austin music that being away from it for 4 months was hard.
You know? Right, right.
And nobody toured to Anchorage, you know, so
right.
I didn't see anything up there. So when I came back that fall, I was like really determined that in addition to the other stuff I was doing at the Statesman, I really wanted to start writing about music. And I asked them if I could write something about this band that was playing at Liberty Lunch that September, 10,000 Maniacs, who I had become a huge fan of.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, we don't know, you've never done this before, but I guess we'll let you try it. And then I did it, and they thought it was pretty good. And so then I started doing that pretty regularly.
Yeah. Wow. What year was that? Was that article?
That was September of 87.
So that's like right when that first record came out.
It was when their first big record came out. They had two previously, but it was right when In My Tribe, which was the one that made them.
In My Tribe, that was it. Yeah, yeah, like with Peace Train and stuff on it, right?
Yeah.
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 All right. So that's funny because that to me is sort of like that. Star 107, the Jody Denberg program directing from when I moved back here in 1991. The sound of Natalie Merchant's voice reminds me very much of that radio station.
He had just started KGSR at 107.1.
Yeah.
And they were a good example of the sort of AAA radio thing that he was just kind of pioneering along with KBCO in Denver, you know, when they were first doing that.
So. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that it's funny because it's Natalie Merchant's voice and World Party. Those were the two bands that really stood out to me as the sound of that radio station when I moved here.
I can totally see that.
And
that was right about 91 was, I guess, was the year you moved here.
I moved back here. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the year I left.
Okay, where did you go?
In 91, I won the Austin Chronicle Music Writer Award at the Music Awards.
Uh-huh.
And from the stage of Palmer Auditorium, I told everybody that by the end of the year I was moving to Seattle. And they were, I had just been there for the first time the week before and had been there for 4 or 5 days in the middle of, like, first week of March, weather was terrible, but I loved the city anyway.
Right.
And it was clear that there was a lot going on there musically. It was very different than the music that was happening in Austin.
Yeah.
There was some crossover, but totally different scene, but really alive kind of a place, and I just loved how beautiful it was up there. And so by the end of the year, by September, I made the move up there, and I arrived in Seattle the week that Nevermind was released.
Wow.
So my timing was kind of good. You know?
That's amazing. Who did you write for up there?
I pretty immediately, the first thing I did was the Seattle Times. There were two daily papers there. Okay. And the Seattle Times hired me to write something about the movie Slacker, which had just been part of their film festival up there, I think, or something. And then the people at the other daily paper, the Post-Intelligencer, I guess had seen that, and they started talking to me, and I ended up working for them. And I wrote a weekly column for them every year for the next 10 years about what was happening in the clubs in Seattle. And then I also became a senior editor at a publication called The Rocket, which was a very good music-centered thing, except it was kind of like The Chronicle, except it came out, I think it started monthly and then went bi-weekly, whereas The Chronicle started bi-weekly and then went weekly. But the difference between them is The Chronicle, you know, covers all facets of the community here.
Right.
And The Rocket was specifically a Northwest music thing. So, but it was newsprint like that and came out every 2 weeks. And they had a big part in, I think, early on in like 88, 89, in getting that whole Seattle thing on the map before it went nationwide. It was big regionally because The Rocket did a really good job covering it. So I was really happy to be able to have an opportunity to work for them too.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about like the scene. I just watched this. For some reason, I'm getting Showtime for free. I guess everyone is. This weekend or something.
Oh, wow.
Maybe they feel sorry for
that.
Us. Yeah. Well, there's this great documentary that's produced by Iggy Pop and John Varvatos about punk music. And it's kind of four different episodes and kind of covers like four different scenes. Like obviously New York or Detroit, then New York, and then, you know, all this kind of stuff. When you move into a scene like that, that was definitely a lot more upwardly mobile than Austin's scene was in 1991. And there's this electricity, and it is like the scene in the world right now. Like, what is that like? Were you cognizant when you moved there that was the scene?
When I moved there, no, because it was just starting to happen.
Right.
The one thing that stands out in my memories from that time is I was moving to Seattle, but I was still kind of not sure how I was going to make it work in terms of writing and in terms of just employment. So I kept a foot in with the Statesman back here in Austin and said, look, if Seattle bands are coming through here, then maybe I can, you know, write something about so-and-so band playing at Libby Lunch or whatever.
Right.
And I pitched them on two things that were coming through right at the time that I left. One was Pearl Jam at the Back Room.
Okay.
And they said yes to that. So I interviewed Jeff Ament, the bass player, who I had met on my last trip to Seattle. And so I'm pretty sure I was the first Austin journalist to write about Pearl Jam. And then the other one was Nirvana, who were playing at Liberty Lunch, and the Statesman said, no, we don't think we want to do that. But that's the reason I mentioned that was it kind of at that time, yeah, those things were bubbling up, but it wasn't clear they were going to become, you know, huger, bigger than life.
Right. Then once it took off, is that when that magazine, The Rocket, started going biweekly?
Yeah, I think it was very shortly after that. I think maybe 92 was when they switched from monthly to biweekly. And, so I was, you know, the thing about the Seattle thing, it was certainly clear by 92 that everything was, that Seattle had become this world-class music city. And maybe always had been to a certain extent, but everybody was onto it then. Mm-hmm. But to me, I was still kind of more interested in the stuff that wasn't necessarily what everybody was looking to Seattle for. I didn't really, I did appreciate Nirvana because they were just so freaking great. And Pearl Jam, I really liked from the outset. But I had to learn the backstories there. I had to learn about Green River. I had to learn about Malfunction and Mother Love Bone and all of the things that led to what Pearl Jam became.
Right.
And that was interesting enough in its own right. It was a good learning experience. But I didn't really care for Alice in Chains that much. I had actually written for the Statesman about Queensryche, which was a different thing, but they had sort of made something out of Seattle before Seattle was getting all that attention.
Yeah.
The one I loved was Young Fresh Fellows, who were this underground garage band with this great frontman, Scott McCoy, who is you know, over the next two or three decades became just ubiquitous because he ended up in REM and and became a sort of a key player with so many bands. But at that time, they were still kind of Seattle's little secret, the Northwest, you know, secret cool band. You know?
Right. It must have been insane because then was there an influx of musicians there? Like there must have been in like 1987 and 88 to like, you know, Hollywood to try and make it. And everyone's like showing up in their ripped jeans and flannel shirts, like from Iowa.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people did move there at that time. It was a great time to live there. I mean, I think the 90s were kind of a good time to live almost anywhere, but Seattle especially. I remember there was a local TV station that did a little 30-minute comedy show that aired every Saturday night before Saturday Night Live. It was called Almost Live, and they had a really talented cast. One of the original cast members was Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Oh, that's wow.
And they did this one thing in early 92 when everything kind of blew up, where they were sort of joking about how crazy the local scene had become. And so you'd have like guys from record companies holding up record contracts and standing on the corner and saying, anybody want a record contract? And everybody would walk by and just say, no thanks, I've already got one. You
know? Well, that's what it seemed like that's the only scene like that I actually was cognizant in the business and stuff like that and like watched this happen. And like, it was one of those things where like, well, we're not from Seattle. I wonder when where the next city is going to be, you know?
Right.
How long do you think that lasted? Like, when do you think the oil well kind of dried up? Was it 93, 94?
I think it had pretty much been played out by 93 in terms of artists. You know, one signal that I always pointed to was when Candlebox got a big record deal, to me it was over. That was like Layers of Pretenders beyond and artists that I don't think ordinarily would necessarily have gotten signed, other than that it was just this Seattle is a thing. But there's a very easy endpoint to put on it, and that was Kurt's death.
Yeah.
There's a guy in Seattle named Ben London who recently started up Seattle chapter of Black Fret, the Austin organization. Ben's a really smart guy and a good musician. He was in bands then. He was in a band in the early 90s called Alcohol Funny Car, who were really cool, you know, punkish indie band, the kind of band that you might see in Austin playing at Barracuda or the Mohawk or Hotel Vegas.
Yeah.
But they probably were not going to get beyond that, like most bands ultimately are. And he has retold several times this great story of sitting in a limo with his bandmates in New York City because they were being recruited by these major labels, and they heard on the radio Kurt Cobain had died. And he's sitting there in that limo with this major label record company limo in New York City, and he immediately says, well, this is over.
And wow.
He was pretty much exactly right. You know?
Yeah. So how long did you stay in Seattle?
Let's see. It was not long after.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know, I think it's Fairweather. You know Bruce Fairweather?
Mm-hmm.
Bruce and Stephanie?
Yeah. Good friends.
I know
good
those
friend.
Guys. She was my record rep, and then I ended up hanging out with them quite a few times up there. They're very quality people. They took us camping on Vashon Island, where Ian Moore lives.
Yeah, Bruce, a mutual friend introduced me to Bruce, and we became like steadfast golf partners. And we went out every other day, pretty much the entire summer of probably 93 or 94.
Yeah.
All over the whole Puget Sound area. It was almost always Bruce and I, and then sometimes Ed Fotheringham would join us. He was a visual artist who did all of Mudhoney's record covers.
Yeah.
He's pretty well known art style for what he does.
Wow. I wonder if I met him when I was hanging out with them.
Entirely possible. Cause Bruce I just said his name and I forgot it.
I'm drawing a blank too.
They were really good friends. I mean, Ed Fotheringham, they were good friends, and that's how I got to become friends with both of them.
Yeah, they did we went to go see some band one night there, and they were like, oh, hey, Chris is here. You want to meet our friend Chris? I'm like, sure. And it was Chris Cornell. And I told Bruce, I was like, man, that's like the most beautiful person I think I've ever met in real life. Like, I can't believe a person actually looks like that in real life.
Right,
and
right.
His response was, dude, you got to meet his sister. I always thought that was hilarious. Anyway, all right. So when did you move from Seattle? When? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, what happened before I moved was a sort of a transition took place. And this was in the summer, fall of 94. That was when the internet was starting to become a thing. And I got my first email address, America, AOL, in summer of 94. And by that fall, I had started to talk with people there on the old AOL message boards, where it was music fans just geeking out about their favorite band or whatever.
Right.
And there was this one that I stumbled across one day, and it was called No Depression Alt Country. And I was like, well, what's that all about? And so I clicked on it, and I realized that it was it apparently they had just renamed it. It had been an Uncle Tupelo fans board.
Okay.
And that somebody had started up right after Uncle Tupelo broke up in June of 94. And by the time I saw it, they had renamed it No Depression. And they did so because they found themselves talking about all these other bands like the Jayhawks and Gram Parsons and all this other stuff that was sort of part of the bottle rock, is part of that same thing that was kind of catching on around that time. So I became a regular person posting to this group. And then the following spring of 95, my friend Grant Alden, who had been managing editor of The Rocket and had been the number one journalist covering the whole grunge thing throughout the 80s and early 90s, He had left The Rocket, and he had tried to start an art gallery, and that didn't work out. And we were talking one day about, maybe we could find something else to do, some magazine maybe that we could write about this music that I had been telling him about. And I think he says, I don't have the specific memory, he says we were at a Bad Livers show.
Okay.
Which is an Austin band, of course, Danny Barnes and Mark Rubin.
Yeah.
And he said it was at that show that we started talking about maybe we could do a magazine about this kind of music, this sort of outsider country stuff that's indie, that is not mainstream country, but isn't really alternative indie rock either. So that was kind of how that got launched. And by that fall, we had our first issue on the rack, September of 95.
Wow, Sumble. That fast?
Yeah, it came together pretty quickly. It was also really small. I mean, the first issue of it, we we actually did all of the copy makeup at Kinko's, you know, and we were just learning how to maybe do some of that stuff online, and some of that stuff was just starting to exist to be able to do magazine pages on a computer, you know.
Yeah.
So the first one we did, like, really old school, and then gradually we got more built up from then. But by
was an audience for that.
It became very clear quickly that, we printed like 2,000 copies of the first issue, and by a year later we were already printing about 8,000.
Yeah.
And by the time we got to our highest point about a decade later in 2005, it was like 39,000. And that was like the total number of copies that were being printed. So it was never huge, but it became clear early on that it was big enough to be a cool side project to what we were doing.
Right. I just remember it was very important to a lot of people I knew. I remember it's very important to Jeff Klein that he get recognized by the magazine back when he was doing his solo records.
And we did. Yeah.
But I just remember like that was like, I just remember it being like Alejandro. You know what I mean? It was a big thing for guys in my sphere of people that I knew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was cool that I think artists really took to us too, but partly it was because we were paying more attention to a lot of these kind of artists than a lot of other people were, because so much of the national music press was still focused on this, you know, whatever had come in as a result of the Seattle grunge thing,
right,
that was tailing through, or it was still the major, you know, your Michael Jacksons and people like that, and the countryside was all whoever was at the top, you know, Garth Brooks and Shania Twain and all that. So we saw a niche and we filled it, I would say.
Yeah. Do you think that I wonder, because I think sometimes magazines do feed. Do you think that you fed that scene as well? Like people discovered music that inspired them to pick up a guitar and start doing this kind of music because, you know what I'm saying? Because they read about someone in your magazine. Because your magazine seemed to have this thing that like 70s rock journalism in America kind of had, but definitely Britain carried on. Like people read about a band and they have their magazine, like their Q magazine or their Mojo or something. No Depression readers seemed like people, like if they heard about someone new, they went to the record store, they got that record.
I think maybe we had, I mean, there were people who were calling us the American Mojo at the time, which I took as a high compliment.
That's what I thought it was.
Such a great magazine. Yeah. But you know, I suspect we had some role there. We just looked at it as like we're covering what's happening. Whether that influenced the way it happened, maybe. But most importantly, I think we just helped get people who deserved a wider recognition of their music.
Right.
Help to accomplish that. You know, certainly when we named Alejandro Escovedo our artist of the decade, in 1998, before the decade was even over.
Right.
there were people who disagreed with that, but at least it got him into that conversation, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we had an influence on the level of what was being accepted and what was being heard in this alternative country or Americana thing that was emerging, you know?
Yeah. Where do you think it's gone now, that style of music?
You know, it's almost kind of just more ingrained. At the time, it was, you know, it worked for us because it was this unusual thing that you could sort of identify. Now it's harder to identify, I think, because it's so many genres have sort of blended together, which I think is ultimately a really good thing.
Right.
But you know, would you consider, you know, Mumford and Sons and Americana alt country band now? I don't think so, really. I just think of them as a huge pop band.
Yeah.
But they were clearly drew in some of the traditional instrumentation and that sort of thing into what they were doing. So
true. What do you think about where music has gone, like pop music? Did it lose you a long time ago? Like the mainstream sort of?
I don't think it's ever completely lost me, but yeah, that's definitely not where my focus is. There are things once in a while that surface that are huge that I still think are really good, but I haven't really listened to what people would consider top 40 since I was a kid and listening to top 40 radio.
Right.
But you know what's cool, I think, is that it's a lot easier. Well, it has been a lot easier to be at a smaller level and still be really significant. I think of someone like Patty Griffin is a great example of that. You know,
right.
She's not Adele, she's not Lady Gaga, but she's really good and really successful at the level that she's at.
Yeah.
And the problem is that she rose up and got well known right at the time when it was still very financially viable to do that in the late 90s.
Right.
You know, somebody with that talent coming along now has to deal with the fact that selling records is not an income stream anymore. And so it's a lot harder in some ways. And yet I'm amazed to see some of these things that pop up and become big even in a year or two now. So
yeah,
it's a hell of a lot more confusing now, I would say.
Yeah, it is. Let me ask you, is there anything that you've heard that's coming out that you want to recommend to the listeners?
I was just listening to a little bit of Willie Nelson's new record this morning because I
saw you tweet about that. Yeah.
Yeah. His record was supposed to come out next month and it's not coming out till July now. I've been wondering about that, whether artists are going to push back their records as a result of what's happening. I mean, on one hand, it's a record and it's going to be out there and, you know, people are going to stream it, so might as well go ahead and get it out there. But if you've had, if you've coordinated a big touring schedule
right,
behind the record,
right,
does that mean you should wait until you can actually tour? I don't know. People are going to come to different answers, you know, different conclusions about that. I had checked in with the guys from an Austin band, Pike and Sutton, which is Patrice Pike and Wayne Sutton, who were formerly Sister Seven. And
right, right.
Patrice has been doing this residency at the Saxon Pub for a long time now. And they sort of reconvened and made this record under their own name, Pike and Sutton, that was going to come out April 3rd, and I believe it still is. They're still on track for that.
Okay.
And that's a good record. I was impressed by that.
Yeah, it is a good record.
Yeah. The new record by the Mastersons, who are
a
Los Angeles band who lived here for a few years,
yeah,
I think is great. That just came out last month, and you know they were supposed to do a record release thing at Waterloo Records, and that didn't happen for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I actually just had them on the show the other day. They, I love that record, man. And Shooter Jennings, man, what a talent, man. He's been doing some great work.
He has. I mean, I think he's really clearly found his role as a producer more than anything.
Yeah. I also talked to Eliza Gilkes, and I guess her record's supposed to come out on April 10th or something.
Yeah.
But that record's really gorgeous too, man. Amazing.
I've been wondering about that, and I'm supposed to talk to her in the next week or so, and I need to check in and confirm that they're sticking with the release plan. I hope they are. I feel bad for her because she titled this record 2020, and she wrote about these really important things, and it is a very, I think, a good vision of our time. And then suddenly, what 2020 means is something entirely different. So
yeah.
It doesn't by any means negate what she was looking at and writing about on that record. But now it's all through this lens of coronavirus. So I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely adds a different slant to the whole thing. I know you're a big fan of Jamie Harris. I am too. I'm a huge fan of hers.
Yeah.
Hopefully she'll be putting out something at some point. I haven't seen her in a long time.
I know she did, some recording with Mark Hallman here in Austin about a month ago. I got that in just under the wire, probably, when everything kind of went crazy. But she is there. Since I moved back to Austin, we didn't sort of finish that conversation.
Oh, sorry.
I'm just realizing that the no depression thing turned into. I was 10 years in Seattle. I was 10 years in North Carolina, and then the magazine went under during the recession, and I ended up back in Austin in 2014. So I've been back here for 6 years now, and I have thought that the two most promising singer-songwriters I have seen since I've been back were Jamie Harris, who now lives in Nashville, and the other one is Pat Byrne, who moved here from Ireland about a year and a half ago.
I haven't met that guy. I haven't heard of him. He's good.
Super, super talented, yeah. He's actually was kind of known in his own country because Ireland has their own version of that TV show, The Voice.
Uh-huh.
And he actually won it and got a deal with Universal Ireland, whatever, and put out a record that the whole Voice and major label people had a lot of say in, and he didn't really end up liking the record that much. And what he realized is that he didn't really want to be a pop star. He wanted to be a songwriter, and so he came here. And he's been playing regularly at the Saxon Pub. He's just started doing a live stream thing on Wednesdays, I think, is when he's going to do his. But terrific songwriter, and he hooked up with great people in Austin, most specifically Rich Brotherton. Who has had a great background in Irish music and was like the perfect guy for Pat to record with and start playing with here.
So does he keep it in a traditional sort of Irish folk vein?
Not really. Okay. I mean, he does some of that, and they do a. He's got a side band that does that called Ula. That there's several people with Irish music connections, including Andrea McGee
from
Deep Revival, who's part of that.
Yeah,
and that's when they sort of do their traditional Irish thing, is in this band called Ula. But Pat's own stuff is much more, I would say, attuned to the whole Texas singer songwriter thing. You know, it's kind of. I mean, he's not trying to be Towns Van Zandt or Guy Clark, and his Irish nature is too distinctive for that, but he is following their lead as just great storytelling songwriters, I would say.
That's great.
Yeah.
What have you been listening to? Have you been listening to records since you've been isolated, like over the weekend? Did you?
You know, I haven't a lot, and part of that is because work has been so busy with writing about all of the repercussions of all of this.
Right, right.
And it's still been a lot of writing about music and listening to music. Last Thursday, I tuned into basically that entire six-hour Willie Nelson.
The Luck Reunion thing?
The Luck Reunion live stream.
How was it?
Yeah. It was all over the place. Some of it great, some of it ridiculous. But but I heard a lot of stuff, and just watching the Facebook live feed and seeing people's reactions, you know, they're tuning in and they're seeing David Ramirez for the first time, and they're like, wow, this guy's got a great voice. So it was cool just to see how that worked in real time online, and how people who hadn't heard some of these people responded. So it was cool, but I feel like just still through doing my job, even though like everybody else, I can't go out to clubs and see music, I'm still getting so much of it.
Right.
In that time, that when the weekend came, I more just sat at home with my wife and caught up on TV shows and stuff like that.
That's good.
But I'm trying to tune in to as many of these live streams as I can because I just think that's important to support right now, because that's where we are as a music community. That's where you find us.
Yeah, I didn't see the Luck one, but man, the Black Fret one sounded great.
I saw parts of that. I tuned into a little bit of that most days and saw probably 5 or 6 sets by different artists, and they did a terrific job.
Yeah, one-to-one one also sounded really great as well. Usually their sound thing is good, but they've been kind of prepped for that for a while with their...
They've been very, smart, or just, accidentally, fortuitously on top of this already going into it, and I think it's cool. Different people are doing this different ways. It's great if artists can just set up with their, broadcasting from their iPhones in their living room.
Yeah.
But it's also cool to have a more of a pro setup like One to One has.
Yeah, yeah. I've also seen, like, we all, most of us musicians, we have these kind of like condenser microphones that are good, and you can plug it into your thing and do it that way. I've seen a lot of that, but it seems like the most famous people are the most low tech ones, like the Rufus Wainwright's been doing them, and he just puts his phone in front of him. Same with the guy from Coldplay, and I was noticing that some of my bros that have, like, you know, play small places to small audiences normally have like the nicest setup for the thing, but the most of the people playing the arenas and shit like that are just using their phone.
That is pretty funny, but it also, I mean, it's kind of cool in a way. It's like,
yeah,
all those people are tuning into Rufus Wainwright, it's because Rufus is so freaking talented, you know, and they want to hear him regardless of how he's doing it. You know?
Yeah. Well, man, I'm glad that you put that document together. I'm glad that we finally got to talk. I know there's probably a lot of stuff that I'm missing, but I'm glad you're here, and I read your stuff, and I was a big fan of No Depression. And I guess, like, I used to be married to this lady, Tracy Gowdy, that I know did work for you guys back in when we were together and you guys were going strong. And I don't know, just always had a tremendous amount of respect for you. So it's nice to have you on the show.
Well, I appreciate that. And the biggest thing I can say for now is just for Austin musicians tuning in is check out this Austin Freed 60 live stream list and submit your events into it, because that's, you know, when we were doing our picks of who's playing in the clubs and all, I could always just go to all the club schedules online at their websites and find out who's playing.
Right.
But it's a lot harder to do that with this. So if people send in their events, it's great.
And it's good to have it in one centralized place.
Yeah.
Hey,
that's my goal. Yeah.
Do you mind if I take a photo of this for when I post it?
Yeah, sure thing.
All right. Wait, hold on. I'm trying to get this glare out of it. All right, man. Well, thank you so much for doing the show, and good luck. People can follow you at blackstock360.com, and of course find you at austin360.com. At blackstock360 on Twitter.
At blackstock360 on Twitter. Yes, that's right.
Thanks so much, man.
All right. Thanks.
Good luck with everything. Stay safe.
You too.
All right, buddy. Peter Blackstock, what a great conversation, man. A great writer, great journalist, man. Find him over there at austin360.com. You can also find that ever-growing list of daily live streams going on over there, which he's adding to every day. And if you're in a band, don't forget to send him your show. Write him on Twitter at Blackstock360, okay? Great conversation, man. I want to thank him for joining me on the computer there to have a talk. I'm missing having people over at the place. I miss having people over. It is weird. It is a little bit weird. Anyway, thank you to Peter Blackstock for doing the show. Gang, don't forget that you can find this podcast wherever it is that you stream podcasts, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher. You can always go to our website, howdidigethere.podbean.com. Look in the right-hand column and you'll see a list of months and years. Click on there and you can access every show. All 899 shows are available on there. All right? I hope you have a good weekend. Stay safe. Stay sane. Do what you can to keep it together. I'm thinking about you. We're all in this together, man. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay sane. Let's get down.